This is the shape of Texas. In 1917, nine independent Houston oil men organized the Humble Oil and Refining Company. 2 years later, they sold controlling interest in the business to the Standard Oil Company of New Jersey. Jersey Standard let the nine co-founders operate Humble as its Texas subsidiary and provided them with capital to build the largest oil refinery in the United States in Baytown. Humble built its headquarters in Houston in 1921 at Polk Avenue and Main Street on the south edge of downtown. Rather than challenge Houston's tallest skyscrapers, it was only nine stories tall. However, what distinguished the Humble building architecturally was its restraint, which architects Clinton and Russell of New York used to imply power. The building looked as if it was lifted off Lower Park Avenue in Midtown Manhattan. The architects faced the street walls with a blend of brown tapestry brick, accentuated with classic limestone pilasters. A copper cornice rimmed the roofline. Technologically, it was cutting edge. In 1932, it became Houston's first office building to boast central air conditioning. By 1936, the 17-story Humble Tower rose at the back of the original structure. It was designed by Houston architects John F. Staub and Kenneth Fransheim. With a second addition to the building in 1940, the Humble complex occupied most of a city block. But by the late 1950s, the company began planning a new headquarters, which opened in 1963. It's now the ExxonMobil building. The old Humble headquarters became a rental office building. But in 2002, it was reborn. New Orleans developer Historic Restorations, with Letty Ventures of San Antonio, rehabilitated the original Humble complex as two Marriott hotels, an apartment tower, and retail space. What remains unchanged is the building's sense of metropolitan stylishness, which once again lends a hint of New York to the south edge of downtown Houston. Just south of downtown San Antonio and along the river, there's a neighborhood of historic homes, some quite daring for their day. It's called the King William Historic District. Prosperous German immigrants settled there beginning in the 1860s. Its official name stems from its main street, King William, named for the King of Prussia. The earliest homes were simple limestone structures. However, architects designed many of the later grander ones. James Riley Gordon, who designed 16 Texas courthouses, designed the home of the pharmacist George Caltire, with massive masonry turrets and towers. Alfred Giles designed homes for the lumberman Edward Steeves and the banker Carl Gross. The Gross house features elaborate Victorian tracery on its galleries and an Italianate cupola. The two-story Steeves homestead is built in the Victorian French Second Empire style. Today, it's a museum. Indeed, the roster of King William's early residents reads like a who's who of San Antonio's civic and business life. The city's first parks commissioner, Anton Wolf, lived at 107 King William in a house modeled after an Italian villa. It has a square tower and paired windows. At 241 King William is the home built for Alexander Josky of the mercantile empire Joskys. It's built in the colonial revival style with tall chimneys that tower over the shingled roof and limestone Ionic columns. By the 1920s, the neighborhood fell out of fashion. Some homes were converted to apartments, but decades later, King William was rediscovered and restorations began. In 1968, it was designated the first historic neighborhood district in Texas. Artists, writers, and family now live there. Walking tours along the shady streets and historic bed and breakfast inns give visitors a taste of the glory days of King William. The Gulf Building in Houston speaks of the modern skyscrapers built in 1920s New York City, but the story it tells is a typically Texan tale about big dreams, banking, and big oil. Completed in 1929, it was the tallest building in Texas, rising 428 feet. Until 1963, it dominated the Houston skyline. It was designed by New York architect Kenneth Fransheim in collaboration with Houston architect Alfred C. Finn. Real estate developer Jesse H. Jones built the skyscraper, but he gave the naming rights to the business that leased the most space, Gulf Oil Corporation. Gulf's regional headquarters remained there for more than 50 years, sharing the building with the National Bank of Commerce, headed by Jones. J.P. Morgan Chase Bank now owns the building, which bears its name. Restoration by architects Sykes, Jennings, Kelly of Houston brought back its original glamour. Today, more than 30 other Houston skyscrapers soar past the 36-story slender tower, yet, still, it stands out. The building's five-story base is faced with limestone. Above, the office tower is faced in buff brick and rises in tiered stages. The effect? A wedding cake in profile. At street level, there are three-story entrance portals with scalloped molding, decorative cast iron screens painted silver, frame windows on the second floor. Inside, the vaulted entrance lobby and the banking hall include polished travertine and limestone walls, patterned terrazzo floors, and decorative ornament in polished nickel. Eight frescoes in the lobby portray Texas historical scenes. Above the Travis Street entrance, a two-story stained glass panel depicts the Battle of San Jacinto. Early on, the Gulf Building was featured in a promotional photograph titled The Little New York of the South. 75 years later, this Texas record breaker still gives visitors the sensation that they're stepping into Art Deco Manhattan. The Julia Idison Building opened in 1926 as Houston's first grand public library and the first building in a planned civic center. It was to include five public buildings designed in the Spanish Renaissance Revival style. The library's principal architect, Ralph Adams Cram of Boston, deemed that appropriate in a southern land once owned by Spain. But the Idison has always stood alone in its Spanish splendor. Plans for the original Civic Center were dropped during the Great Depression. In the late 1930s, several public buildings were built in the more up-to-date, modern style. The Julia Idison Building was named for Houston's longtime librarian. Its three-story limestone entryway, arched windows, and carved limestone railing at the roof are derived from Spanish architecture. Faces and animals carved around doors and windows contrast with plain buff brick walls. The building's floor plan addressed Houston's heat and humidity. Two wings form an L, providing cross ventilation. The doors to the porch off the two-story reading room on the second floor could be left open even during rainstorms. The second-story atrium is the heart of the building. Here, the architect wove his story of a fabled Spanish past for Houston. Four marble columns with connecting entablatures support a balcony. Carvings of women's faces and of children's torsos enliven the ceiling. Light filters down from clear-story windows. The Idison Building served as Houston's central library until 1976, when a larger, modern building opened next door. 3 years later, the Idison was restored by S.I. Morris Associates and given a new role in Houston's library system. It houses archives, special collections, a Texas room, and something more. Its magical architecture reminds visitors that greatness comes from studying the lessons of the past, which are stored here in books that feed the mind and stir the imagination. It's one of the tallest buildings in Texas, 75 stories, rising more than 1,000 feet above downtown Houston. Take a ride in the Sky Lobby elevator to the observation deck on the 60th floor, and you'll get a breathtaking view of the city skyline. It's the J.P. Morgan Chase Tower, but many Houstonians still call it Texas Commerce Bank Tower, named for the lead tenant of the building when it opened in 1980. It was designed by the celebrated architectural firm I.M. Pei and Partners of New York City and built by Houston developer Gerald Hines, an innovator in his own right. Other Hines projects in downtown Houston from the same period were given striking images by their architects to establish their presence on the skyline and in a crowded real estate market. For example, think of the paired, rhomboid shapes of Pennzoil Place or the Gothic-inspired step-back towers of the Bank of America building. The J.P. Morgan Chase Tower is huge but subdued by comparison. In form, it's a tall square with a corner sliced away to form a five-sided building. It's faced on four sides by a grid of square, dark glass windows, alternating with squares of polished gray granite. The side with a truncated corner is faced in alternating bands of dark glass and stainless steel. IMPEI is best known for buildings with crisp geometry and smoothly detailed surfaces, such as the East Wing of the National Gallery in Washington, D.C., and the renovations of the Louvre in Paris, where he added a glass and steel pyramid above a new underground entry to the museum's 18th century stone buildings. Geometry also inspired IMPEI's design of Houston's J.P. Morgan Chase Tower, fitted to the world of business and finance for a dynamic city. Architectural historian Stephen Fox calls the iconic building the quintessential skyscraper in the gray granite suit, always in style. Pennzoil Place put Houston on the architectural map. Not even the Astrodome, which was called the eighth wonder of the world when it opened in 1966, attracted as much attention. One national architectural critic said that with the completion of Pennzoil Place, Houston displaced Los Angeles as America's city of the future. Hyperbole aside, Pennzoil Place is a remarkable project. It was designed by New York architect Philip Johnson and was completed in 1976. Pennzoil Place is not one, but two towers, separated by a 10-foot gap and clad in bronze-colored glass with bronze-colored exposed window mullions that run from the street to the roof. And what a roof! For a generation, American architects had designed rectangular steel and glass buildings with squared-off roofs. But at Pennzoil Place, Johnson slashed the roof lines to form asymmetrical trapezoids. One slanting surface faces east, one faces north. With that simple yet modern gesture, Johnson reclaimed the excitement of the building top that had been a standard element of skyscraper design during the 1920s. The building made Houston developer Gerald Hines a celebrity and touched off a round of experimentation with building tops that continued for 15 years. A combination of eye-catching forms and cost-saving construction techniques made Philip Johnson and Gerald Hines the best-known architect and developer team in the nation during the 1980s. Yet what made Pennzoil Place in Houston so successful was not just striking imagery, but also the design's business savvy. Hines said the decision to build two towers instead of one saved him upfront money on elevators and structural steel, and that allowed him to lease to two lead tenants, a formula for extra profitability. From 1891 until 1940, streetcars transported Houston residents between their neighborhoods and downtown. The automobile changed that, beginning with jitneys, which carried passengers for a fee. As the city sprawled and freeways were built, Houstonians became wedded to their cars. They also considered buses the future of public transportation. By the late 20th century, attitudes about mass transit began to change as the city sought more efficient ways to move people and redevelop its urban core. Houston's Metrorail debuted in 2004. Its sleek, silent trains run along the overhead electric wiring with fixed iron rails at street level. Like silver bullets, they whisk passengers along 7.5 miles of track on Main Street, the city's urban spine. The initial route begins at the University of Houston, downtown near Buffalo Bayou. It continues through the Central Business District to Midtown, the Museum District, Rice University, the Herman Park and Zoo, and the Texas Medical Center. Then it crosses Brays Bayou and ends near the Astrodome Reliant Stadium complex. At Metrorail's 17 stations, metal and glass canopies shelter travelers waiting to hop on board the trains. Artists and architects have modified the station's prototype to reflect the surrounding neighborhoods. For instance, at the Museum District stops, there's an expressionistic pattern of colored circles on the canopies and green and purple concrete below, allusions to the art that's just steps away. There's more rail to come, 72 miles of it. One line will connect the northern neighborhoods to downtown. An eastern line will run through the historic Magnolia and Harrisburg neighborhoods, terminating near Hobby Airport. With a public transportation system that links the city's core with surrounding neighborhoods, Houston is embarking on what E.M. Forster once wrote was the key to life. Just connect. During the next 30 years, drop a quarter into a parking meter on the northern edge of downtown Houston, and you'll be helping to pave a redevelopment that's revitalizing a once blighted area. In the late 1990s, these streets were the shortest pedestrian link between Houston's growing West Side Arts District and the new baseball and basketball stadiums planned for the east side of downtown. But it was a place most people wanted to avoid, filled with boarded-up buildings facing narrow, broken sidewalks. The City of Houston, with the nonprofit Downtown Management District and the Cultural Arts Council of Houston-Harris County, started rebuilding with revenues from more than 3,000 parking meters and other public funds. The idea to rescue the 100-block area began with the private Cotswold Foundation, named for the famous walking region in England. Though the plan was modified, the name Cotswold stuck for the $61 million project. Pedestrians walking from the light rail station on Main Street to Minute Maid Park or to the Arts District now find wide, brick-lined sidewalks, repaved streets, oak trees that already are providing shade, and a variety of public artworks. These include the fountains on Preston and Congress Avenues. Some are abstract, sheets of water pouring down walls of glass or stone. Others are witty evocations of Houston life, such as the fountain on Preston at Louisiana, where water seems to flood up from two pulled-back stone manhole covers. The fountain on Preston, closest to Minute Maid Park, is a 5-foot-tall stone sphere carved with baseball stitching, which seems to have slammed a crater into the brick sidewalk. New shops, bars, and restaurants also are opening in the area, joining the gentle sound of flowing water, thanks to the Cotswold Project's vision, and parking meters filled with change. When the Hobby Center for the Performing Arts opened in 2002, Houston's downtown theater district became second only to New York's in size. But it took 12 years of dreaming and planning for that to happen. Originally, the 1936 Houston Music Hall was to be renovated as the Hobby Center. That plan changed after Houston lost the premiere of the Broadway musical The Lion King to Minneapolis because the music hall was too small. It was demolished to make way for the larger $92 million new building. The Hobby Center includes two performance halls with more than 3,100 seats. Seraphim Hall accommodates large Broadway musicals. Zilka Hall serves small and mid-size local arts groups. The building's 8,700-square-foot lobby may steal the show. New York architect Robert A.M. Stern and the Houston firm Morris Architects designed it to be a front porch that's open to the street. The lobby's 5-story back wall is constructed with 250 tons of limestone. It's washed by sunlight that filters from a triangular skylight. The front is a glass curtain wall that's covered by a swooping porch roof. Tilting columns support the roof and try to reach across the street to Tranquility Park, which commemorates the astronauts landing on the moon. This configuration places audiences that gather in the lobby between the sun and the moon. That's appropriate because Theater Under the Stars, a resident company, calls Seraphim Hall its home. And the ceiling of the hall extends the metaphor. It's a midnight blue dome covered with fiber optic stars that depict the Texas sky at the summer solstice. Houston's theater district now can accommodate more than 16,000 people for live performances by world-class orchestras, opera companies, theater companies, and ballet troupes. But only the Hobby Center places its audience under the setting sun and the midnight sky at the same time.
Transco Tower in Houston is a true skyscraper, a slender, gleaming, glass-covered obelisk. Designed by architects Philip Johnson and John Berge of New York and built in 1983 by Houstonian Gerald Hines, Transco stands 901 feet tall with 64 stories. It's a world-famous postmodern-style tower. To make their buildings appealing, postmodernists reacted against the flat-topped, squared-off restraints of architectural modernism. The architects designed Transco Tower to echo the skyscrapers built in New York City during the 1920s. Other skyscrapers crowd downtowns. Transco Tower, the world's tallest building outside a downtown, is surrounded by low-scale neighbors in Houston's Galleria area. Isolated, it's a landmark visible for 15 miles. Looking down from a floor-to-ceiling window located high in the Transco Tower is dizzying, like being launched over a vast space. The half-inch-thick windows are the building's only walls. Early buildings were constructed with exterior concrete or steel structural frames, with windows set into those frames. Transco was created soon after engineers discovered how to build skyscrapers with stiff inner cores and without perimeter framing. At the same time, reflective and light-absorbing glass panels made it possible to omit shading devices used in earlier buildings. Thus, windows and walls could be one and the same. Transco's design is both aesthetic and efficient. Glass window walls with no space lost to framing maximize floor space rented to dozens of corporations. Transco Tower sits in a grassy 3-acre park enhanced by a 30-foot horseshoe-shaped water wall. A brick and concrete proscenium modeled loosely on an Etruscan temple facade fronts the water wall, which roars and foams. The small-scale historic reference contrasts with the huge glass tower across this pocket park where children play and visitors explore the sights and sounds of Houston's suburban skyscraper. The tiny, pristine houses stand shoulder to shoulder in ruler straight rows on a wide street in Houston's Third Ward. There's poetry in the procession of identical boxy shapes topped by metal roofs pointed skyward. The spare structures are project row houses, an alliance of creativity and activism. Not long ago, the 22 houses just south of downtown were droopy, derelict shells. Now they're shipshape, brought back to life to serve art, the neighborhood, and struggling families. Built in the late 1930s as rentals when the area was thriving, the one-story houses are models of economy. Each is roughly 550 square feet with clapboard walls, corrugated tin roofs, and corner porches. Cookie-cutter details complete the picture. Front double window, louvered attic grill, 3 concrete steps, 1 square porch post. No fuss, no frills. The style is rooted in the shotgun houses brought to the South by freed Haitian slaves and reaches back to West Africa. A Houston artist discovered the tumble-down houses in 1992. He pictured studio space for African-American artists whose presence would lift the languishing community. A nonprofit organization formed and gathered $125,000 in money and materials. Volunteers repaired porches, foundations, wiring, and plumbing. They scraped, sanded, and painted the houses white again. The roofs are watertight now, but still nut brown with rust. Project Row Houses opened in 1994. It has been honored with a national award for urban excellence. 7 structures house young, single mothers with children. 5 shelter daycare and after-school programs and offices. 10 are rotating art installations. They have included a shrine to collard greens and a project tribute with 22 miniature houses, photographs, and a 22-line poem, which ends, "Row house, row house, looking real good. Taking care plenty business in the neighborhood."
Houston's lack of zoning laws has had an unintended result. It's given rise to handmade architectural environments constructed with anything from flowers to beer cans. They're the work of self-taught artists, individuals with an obsession to create, and they've become cultural treasures. The most famous is the Orange Show. In a modest neighborhood near downtown, it's the vision of the late Jeff McKissick, a retired postal worker who had a passion for oranges. From 1962 to 1979, McKissick constructed a series of imaginative landscapes that pay homage to the orange. He believed that the fruit transmitted the sun's energy to humankind. "Eat oranges and live," he inscribed in broken tiles on the walls of the Orange Show. The indoor-outdoor environment includes a museum and a pair of amphitheaters. One is centered on a shallow pool and features a scaled-down steamboat. The roof deck of the museum overlooks both amphitheaters. It's outfitted with tractor seats painted in bright colors. They're part of an exuberant array of artifacts that McKissick made or adapted to decorate the Orange Show. He also used clown figures, whirligigs, wagon wheels, awnings, and Texas and American flags. McKissick boasted that 100,000 architects and 100,000 engineers put together couldn't conceive of such a show. He also touted his creation as the biggest thing to hit Houston since the Astrodome, but on opening day in 1979, only 150 people showed up. McKissick died later that year. In 1980, a group of his admirers formed a foundation to acquire the Orange Show. Houston architect Barry Moore rehabilitated the complex. It's become a center for the study and practice of what's called outsider art, folk art, or visionary art. Today, visitors come from near and far to experience the Orange Show. just as Jeff McKissick knew they would. For The Shape of Texas, produced by South Texas Public Broadcasting, I'm Bill Clough. Funding is provided by Texas Architect Magazine and the Texas Society of Architects at texasarchitect.org.